This is Scott Verguin of KSOW Radio in Cottage Grove. We actually have on the phone Brian Bogart, who is beginning and part of a strike for peace on the University of Oregon campus tomorrow, as well as other campuses, I believe. But let's go right to Brian and hear what's up. Hello, Brian.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Interested to hear the details of the plan and basically what's going on and where and how folks can support this action.
Wonderful.
So why don't you start from the beginning?
Okay. Well, I'm the only graduate student in peace studies at the University of Oregon, and have been for 3 years. I'm now entering my fourth and final year. And actually, as far as I know, I'm the only peace studies student, period, among 20,000 students here. And I've learned too much about war, the war industry, and how our schools are cooperating with the Defense Department to receive funds. We have more than 350 universities making weapons on campuses around the country in exchange for funding. And for me, I just cannot in good conscience, do the usual courses, sit inside a classroom for my final year, knowing what I know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to announce on Monday at a noon rally at the U of O Amphitheater in Eugene that I will strike all year long and refuse to study inside the classroom of any school that sells itself to war. And I've written a petition called the Petition for Peaceful Priorities, which Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange and Code Pink is delivering to the White House at noon on Monday. And at that same time, I'll deliver it to President Dave Frohnmayer of the University of Oregon. And then I'll walk across the street and set up a tent facility for the entire year across from Johnson Hall, the administration building. And I'll speak from noon until dark every day about the war industry as I've uncovered it over the past few years to anyone that walks by, and try and encourage the public to get involved.
Okay, well, that brings up a lot of questions, but I'll start with, you said that, basically said the University of Oregon and 350 other colleges and universities in this country are making weapons on campus. You want to clarify what you mean by that?
Yeah. Any colleges or universities that have research departments are excellent targets for the Department of Defense to outsource its defense weapons programs. Basically, our funding throughout our 50 states for education has been cut for the last 5 years or so to focus on military adventures overseas. And actually, this has been going on since after World War II. In January 1950, President Truman adopted a war economy and launched the Cold War. And that has led us to perpetuate a state where our industries require conflict around the world. More than 200 wars have happened since we launched the Cold War then.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Cold War ended, we were faced, in fact, with an industrial crisis called peace. And so the Pentagon began outsourcing its programs so that, everything from bullets to bathroom slippers and bathrobes has been outsourced to our companies around the country. So our schools are deeply involved in all the companies that you and I know, like even Bumblebee Tuna and Hallmark Cards, are all selling things to the Pentagon to fill our bases around the world. So this whole military industry complex is deeply rooted in our economy. And the best place, in my mind, to begin exposing that is through the obvious hypocrisy of learning, institutions of higher learning, developing weapons on campuses. And there are several very terrible weapons projects that we're working on here at the University of Oregon, including one called the Brain-Machine Interface Project that the Defense Department developed earlier in this decade. And it's to remote control human soldiers by the year 2008, and that's terrible.
So this, they're working on some kind of microchip or something? This is...
Right. They're actually integrating microtechnology with nanotechnology to allow human soldiers to receive signals from satellites. And they've actually, this is going to sound terrible, but they developed this so that they could control rats and monkeys and actually run them around rooms like radio remote control cars. And they're now adapting that technology for human soldiers. It's a terrible, terrible situation.
So what are there specific departments that you would be focusing on, I mean, that are taking on this? Or does it look like it's just kind of whoever can get the money to fund research will take it?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point. Because you know, these research departments, there's a lot of good people in these research departments. I myself was in the defense industry for 15 years, not because I volunteered to do any defense work. I was just happened to be working in a semiconductor firm that adopted programs that were for the defense department. You know, I began making chips for televisions and ended up making chips and parts for bombs and missiles, and finally quit working for three companies every time they approached me for CIA or Defense Department security clearance. I turned them down and finally just left Silicon Valley and came up here to get an education.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, these departments are not to blame. It's what's happening is the Senates, campus Senates, have the ultimate authority. And they are being circumvented by university presidents who have their own club called the Association of American Universities. And the AAU is just a lobby for Defense Department funds. That's all they do. And so these presidents have gotten together and systematically bypass university senates to get massive funding for their universities. And that's why we have enough money to build new buildings and sports stadiums and things like that. So it's
okay. So do they actually, in your opinion, actually have the authority to do this, or
no?
Is this...
And that's what this campaign is all about. And I'll be explaining that a lot on strikeforpeace.org,
okay,
which is our new website that just went up. Right. And what we're going to do is inform Senate members at campuses around the country that they have the authority and the moral imperative to be informed about this and to take the appropriate action so that our institutions of enlightenment are for the purpose of enlightenment and not for military training or weapons building.
Right. So it's an amazing parallel between the situation we find ourselves in our national government, federal government, with the Congress basically abdicating to the executive branch in terms of war powers. And so here you've got the same thing happening.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
An excellent point. It's very disturbing.
Yeah.
I've been conducting a study, helping a study with Project Censored down at Sonoma State University. And we've found that the top board members of the Fortune 500 companies, all of the board members also sit on the boards of other companies that are defense related.
Mm-hmm.
And so this keeps America, stuck in this military-based economy,
mm-hmm,
which was adopted in 1950, while other nations like Europe, nations there have public-based economies, so their people prosper, and so their technologies are not advanced for war. They're using nanotechnology and microtechnology to solve energy problems,
mm-hmm,
and we're not. You know, we're out there threatening the rest of the world and actually forcing many other countries to adopt a more militaristic position with their technology as well.
Well, so this is basically the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned of in a speech back in the 50s, I believe it was.
Absolutely. And that speech was on the last day he was in office. He gave that warning to the American public on the last day that he was leaving office in January 1961. That was the bravest thing I've ever seen a president do. And my family did not support Eisenhower then. You know, I was only, 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly have gained a tremendous amount of respect for Dwight Eisenhower as with respect to foreign policy, mm-hmm, in my studies.
Sure. Well, he certainly was a, unlike what we unfortunately have now in our government, he was a person who actually had seen war, for certain. and knew, of course, a lot about the implications of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, okay, so what kind of support do you have locally first, and then I'd like to also hear how this is taking shape beyond the University of Oregon?
Mm-hmm. Well, locally, it's been wonderful. I've had a lot of support with the professors on campus and generally groups around town that share the same concerns. So many progressive groups are addressing the symptoms of this situation, this cause, mm-hmm. this policy that was adopted in 1950 that turns American priorities to foreign military adventures rather than domestic prosperity. So a lot of these groups are very supportive and are helping to launch the campaign on Monday and assist with things down the road. So that's very, very helpful. Nationally, I have a tremendous amount of support from professors around the nation, including Robert Jensen, School of Journalism in Austin, Texas, mm-hmm. and Noam Chomsky, who's been an advisor of mine for a long time. Many students are you know, very interested. The problem is, of course, when, you know, this is the first couple of weeks of school that we're entering, mm-hmm. and a lot of students are just, you know, settling in, so it'll take a few weeks for the students to really catch on, and so it's going to be a slow building movement throughout the academic year, but we certainly have a great advantage in having a great strategy to give campus senates. And I'm just filled with Pentagon statistics here that we're going to put online, mm-hmm. Revealing these 310,000 companies that are working, making money from the Pentagon. Now, we're not targeting these companies at all. We're mm-hmm. just going to pressure them, hopefully by popular demand, to please, in turn, ask the Pentagon to pursue a more reasonable defense so that domestic prosperity is increased and so that, you know, we don't have this corporate nation, so that mm-hmm. it returns to, you know, the people in charge.
Well, it seems like it's not much of a leap to go from 310,000 corporations, companies that are profiting in some way, to wars being fought to, I think you alluded to this early on, wars being fought just to keep the industry going.
Absolutely. That's been the whole problem with our political system since World War II. You know, we were militaristic before World War II, but this became official in January 1950. We had 250 atomic bombs, and the Soviet Union had just tested their first, mm-hmm. and we launched the Cold War. And I have evidence, we have evidence that the Korean War was started by America because they wanted to launch a permanent war economy. Mm. And the person who wrote this document that instituted this policy was a former Wall Street executive. His name was Paul Nitze. And the document was called NSC 68, and it was filled with fear rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And one of his students was Paul Wolfowitz. And when the Cold War ended, Paul Wolfowitz got together with his disciples, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Louis Libby, and a couple of others, and created the plans for the War on Terror. And this was back in 1992, well mm-hmm. before they even got close to running for election. So, yes, we've been perpetuating war. The Cold War was perpetuated for the industry, and when it ended, the peace dividend just was not interesting to corporations that were making so much money selling weapons.
Right.
And there was this new movie that just came out, I hear, about an arms dealer, and it talks about the need for wars in order to keep the business going, and that's exactly what America is stuck in. Our top industry has been the manufacture and sale of weapons since World War II, and we rely on conflict around the world, unfortunately.
Right, and like you said, you could. There's been so many, there's a long list of conflicts that certainly we either directly or indirectly involved in around the world since
right.
that time. So you could I mean, it's really not even that sinister in some ways. I mean, there is a sinister level to this, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. But one can look at it, if you're not willing to look at it at that level, to just go, okay, just look at it at the lobbying level. Mm. How, say, let's talk about something that's not specifically or directly war-related. Somebody lobbies to get the laws changed so that they can sell more eggs. Mm-hmm. And their interest is wrapped up in selling eggs, and so they go, and it affects their opinions.
Right.
And so you've got companies that make a lot of money off building weapons and researching all that, and that's going to wildly affect their opinions and what they lobby for, and of course who they support in elections too. So,
exactly.
I mean, given it the fact that what you say, you know, that it started in 1950, and it's really like the beginning of this what we now call the neocons, mm-hmm. The Project for New American Century and that sort of stuff.
Right.
That it does take on more of a conspiratorial feeling.
Yeah.
And I know I think that's probably something that you are up against here, is that Americans seem to have, aided by the media and the government, a penchant for not wanting to, you know, I don't know how to say this, but don't want to get into conspiracies.
The right.
Conspiracies. They're afraid to be the person who says, I believe there's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff sounds like a very massive industrial and governmental and corporate conspiracy, in the sense that they've got a plan.
Right. And it's funny, you know, it's not so much a conspiracy as just a way of life.
Uh-huh.
It's been, you know, our culture has been saturated with, well, you know, if you're American, the whole idea of living is profit. And, you know, that's radiated from our media, unfortunately, because that isn't the whole meaning of our culture as far as the founding fathers were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the country is supposed to be run by the people. Our servants are in the White House, not our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, you know, throughout the Cold War, you know, we've had this mindset of competition and gain at the expense of, you know, worldwide suffering at this point.
Sure.
But yeah, in 1969 was when Paul Wolfowitz was working under Paul Nitze and first met Cheney and Rumsfeld, and they began creating think tanks because Dean Acheson, Secretary of State under President Truman back in 1950, banned the input of any single individual who might have been an expert. There was an expert on the Soviet Union named George Kennan who tried to stop the Cold War from being launched, and he was fired, and Dean Acheson made a law that said no individual could offer opinion on policy. So these think tanks in the 60s became very powerful. I mean, especially they're very powerful now, because their large groups of individuals are allowed to offer opinion on
mm-hmm.
policy. And so that's why these think tanks popped up. And
really? That's very fascinating. So so essentially, I don't even know if they're around anymore, but the RAND Corporation of Daniel Ellsberg,
mm-hmm.
That he was involved in with some, is that's the type of thing you're talking about.
Yeah, and ironically, I just became a licensed member of RAND to access their database, because it's a lot more accessible than the Pentagon's files. And I have no ties with RAND Corporation, but they're offering to the public. You can apply for a license to you know, peruse their database. And so now I'm able to find all these defense files that the Defense Department has been hiding for the last several. We've lost millions and millions of documents every month since the Bush administration took power. It's very hard to find lists of schools that are being funded by the Defense Department anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to go back to 2002, and then they mixed all these other departments in. In order to create a list, you have to filter out all these other departments. It's just a real pain,
mm-hmm.
but it's wonderful to have access to a completely different database.
Right. Hmm.
Very helpful.
So I have to admit, I don't understand this this thing about no individual can have input into policy, or whatever you said that mm-hmm. Dean Acheson put into place. So that's something that's still in place?
Yeah.
Was it a law that was eventually passed
yeah.
by Congress or something? That, or is it an administrative policy?
Right. It was an administrative policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess it was just when they were opening the Pentagon, and they had just created the Department of Defense, And you know, individuals were getting together to plot the Cold War in the White House. And when George Kennan, you know, made his attempt, you know, originally he had worked in the Soviet Union for 20 years, and he was very much paranoid about Stalin and what the Soviet Union would do after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a lot of things, sending, you know, he sent a long telegram of 8,000 words back to Washington from Moscow, saying how terrible Moscow was. You know, he was living in horrible conditions because Moscow was, you know, the Soviet Union was in a war, and things were in bad shape. So his opinions changed feelings, or hardened feelings, anti-Soviet sentiments in Washington. And when he returned from Moscow in 1946, he began to see that his own writings to Washington had cemented this kind of assumption that the Soviet Union was a terrible nation that was about to invade the entire world, which it, of course, didn't have the capability of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he then began to try and reverse course by, you know, telling people, well, no, it's not that way. I didn't mean to create a monster. You know, listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only expert here. You know, listen to me. And we should have a discussion with the Soviets and reach a mutual agreement on these weapons and stop this Cold War before you launch it. And he was fired for it, and he was told to go preach his Quaker gospel outside the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's when they made that rule. And I'm actually not sure if it went through Congress, but it certainly went through the cabinet, and it just shut the door on George Kennan and every other individual.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's something that it would be very interesting to talk about some other time.
Mm-hmm.
But it... Okay, let's come back to the present, or at least tomorrow.
Right.
At noon, you will pitch a tent, as you said.
Yeah.
And you are going to basically lecture, do a lecture on the things that you have found out each day from noon till dark.
Yeah.
For the school year.
Right. I'm basically just going to repeat myself.
Okay. Okay.
You know, because students will be coming and going.
Right, right.
You know, I'm not asking people to strike from their classes. You know, tomorrow afternoon, I am, you know, kind of saying, hey, if you want to take the afternoon off, the first day of school is the day to do it, because it's usually syllabus day, and it's not a big deal. You usually won't get thrown out of class for missing the first day.
Right.
But, yeah, every day I'll just be talking, you know, repeating myself every half hour or so on basics. I don't want to overwhelm anyone with all of the history that I just mentioned, but I will make it available in essays on strikeforpeace.org.
Okay.
But, you know, I want to give everyone statistics on how many companies are in their towns, how many schools are involved in this, and how it's really been pervasive recently.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, basically I will be repeating myself a lot. But I did that in the defense industry. It was very repetitive. So in this way, I kind of make up for those years when I was producing parts.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to produce peace here.
So are you asking, what specifically are you asking for other students, other, you know, well, professors, whatever, to do? And what is it that you are hoping people will replicate across the country?
Right. Well, I'm handing in a petition tomorrow, but actually I'll be collecting signatures all year long and delivering those signatures to the White House next June.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to do is, in collecting signatures, that is really just a means for approaching and informing the public.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to talk to people in our communities around the country and inform them of the massive nature of this industry, that 51% of our taxes go to defense, that we're spending over $1 trillion a year on war and only $59 billion on education. You know, statistics like that are very, that reveal our priorities are not domestic prosperity and things like that. And hopefully build a momentum throughout the year so that by springtime, young people will be a force, because they are a great consumer force. If they become a force of opinion, like Noam Chomsky's second superpower of popular opinion, they can persuade companies to adopt a more peaceful idea and help pressure the Pentagon to pursue a more reasonable defense I hope to ask for strikes and walkouts next spring so that people take the afternoon off and gather. Ultimately, I hope that everyone will join me in coming to Washington, D.C. to deliver those signatures in June.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope it's not just an event like we just had yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's actually an action that's very different, because I've been in the peace movement for so long and nothing has changed. It's just gotten worse. And so I think we really have to peacefully confront our officials and remind them whose White House that really is and whose capital that is. That's, you know, they're our servants and they should be held accountable for the state this country is in right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Are there, it's blowing my mind to use an old term, that there's 350,000 corporations, or I assume corporations and businesses of various forms,
mm-hmm.
that are involved in some way in the defense industry. That just is mind-boggling. There's obviously some of the major culprits that most of us know about, the Lockheed Martins,
right.
and so on, Boeing,
yeah.
I imagine, and others.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any that you can think of right off the top of your head that really surprised you when you...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously, probably the universities
right.
surprised you.
Oh, there's so many schools on the list. But, actually, the 310,000 companies...
310, okay.
And, of course, I haven't counted every one.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give you the correct figure, the actual figure. But, it's surprising. Why would the Army pay the New York City Lincoln Center for Performing Arts, for instance, $40,000 a year? The College Entrance Examination Board got $7 million last year. I'd like to know why. like I said, Bumblebee Tuna is making a fortune.
Bumblebee Tuna?
Yeah, Campbell's Soup. Well, the military, the Marines used to make their own soup, and the Army used to make their own tuna sandwiches. But now they've outsourced all these contracts so that tuna sandwiches come prepared, compliments of Bumblebee Tuna. So all of these companies have a stake in conflict, and that's basically that keeps people from speaking out against war. These base realignment and closure hearings are an example of getting domestic workers, to say, hey, don't close down our bases. We need conflict. We need jobs. And I agree, we need defense.
Right.
But we don't need to, have this global reach. It's just ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, another thought I have, and we should wrap this up pretty soon,
Great.
Or we're going to, both go late into
Run
the night
time.
Here. But back when you're talking about the campus senates or university senates or school senates that have really should be the ones who would be deciding on whether Defense Department contracts money comes into the campus. There's this, of course, huge move, which is, I believe, is part of this this whole process of for privatization and removing things from the public domain to the private sector. And this seems like this is actually, I hadn't thought of this before, but this is really part of it.
Absolutely.
Moving towards a business model, which is one person at the top, the CEO, who has the power and makes the decisions and bypasses the people or the people's process, which is either the Senate, the Congress, the vote, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's an excellent point. And that's why so many professors I know here are leaving the University of Oregon, because it's just become so business-oriented that I have some very depressed advisors here.
Oh.
I just read a quote from Dick Cheney's speech at an oil conference a few years ago. But he said, I was told the other day that I was a good candidate to be a CEO because I was so grouchy and I really hated a lot of people and I didn't want any agreement. I just wanted my way. And so I ran for office. That was his excuse for becoming a public servant.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
This privatization thing is really, it's happening globally, too, because the United States is just pressuring all these other countries to act like us and adopt a more belligerent stance about the world. So, that is very much part of it.
Okay. Well, we will certainly touch back, get back in touch with you in the course of things here, because it'll be very interesting to hear how it's going and get more information from you as well to share with folks. We're right on a half an hour, so it's probably a good time to wrap this part of it up. So, boy, have a good day tomorrow. I hope it goes well, and you have a good kickoff to it. And like I said, I'll be very interested in talking to you again.
Fantastic. Feel free to call me on my cell phone to do an interview live from the campaign site.
That'd be great.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Take care.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
That was Brian Bogart of Strike for Peace at strikeforpeace.org. Check it out. If you're in the University of Oregon area, go down and join them at noon tomorrow and every day during the school year, this school year 2005. This is Scott Bergwin from KSOW, signing off. Bye.